Hello and welcome to
Radio.
Hello and welcome to Rum Radio, 12-Step Recovery. Welcome back for any of you that are out there in the radio world. My co-host is Justin. He's with us tonight. If you have any questions.
How you guys doing tonight?
That was Justin?
Yes. Justin, sorry, we had a little delay there for a second.
We're new at this, so try to be kind until we find out what how this thing all works. I wanted to tonight take some time and give you an update on how Rum Radio came about. I think that's important, and I'm going to tell a little bit of my story and. And Justin will tell a little bit of his story, so you see that how we're connected up in the rooms of recovery.
And if you have any questions throughout it, they can call in.
Primarily, we're going to be on the site, rumradio.org, and with this is the overflow, is on sponsorship in 12-step programs, primarily in AA, because AA is the template of all 12-step recovery work. Rum Radio started out, I was doing a workshop at my home group using Hamilton B's book on 12-step sponsorship, How It Works. I had used the book and found it to be very productive in sponsoring men. I was getting a really good response. A lot of the information was cognizant. It uses the big book and the 12 and 12. It made it clear and was able to get through in a timely manner. And I thought, gee, what a great idea. My experience was that most folks didn't know how to sponsor. They hadn't had a clue what a sponsor did and didn't do. And this was some good information to get that out. Having done that for about a year, I had some really miracles happen in the room, but there was never a very large crowd that came in. None of the cliques in the home group embraced it. As new information, it was kind of not accepted. I spoke of this in another group. A fellow friend of mine heard that, and he said, gee, what a great idea. Why don't you put together Rum Radio? And then as a website, I said, I don't know. That's a big commitment. He says, no, it's a legacy. You know, when you get on in years, the word legacy all of a sudden has some impact to you. Did you understand that, Justin?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, something, it's like, what did they used to say? Heroes are remembered, but legends are never forgotten. Or legends live forever.
Oh, I never heard that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, heroes will be remembered, but legends never die.
Huh. My idea, I don't know about a legend, but my idea was to give back.
Absolutely.
And I thought I had the resources to do that. As we grow spiritually, we're supposed to also be able, and you know you're growing spiritually because you grow also in capability. Your ability to help expands with the amount of spiritual growth. Well, if you really work in a good program, you're going to grow. There's just no way around it. But it's not a steady thing. It's two steps forward, back. That's what I've discovered. So I mentioned this the ongoing sponsorship workshop, and we started the website, and I started writing to that. And it's going on 2 years now that Rum Radio has gone through some changes. We're in 71 countries plus around the world. I've had 960 letters from people thanking me for doing this work. And there's other people, Jimmy, Justin, Terrence, Paul, a collaboration of putting this thing together. It's not a one-man band. What I've learned is you don't have to do the work of 10 men. You need 10 good men to do the work. And people have come up and stepped up and have helped more often than not. So initially, you know, the first thing is something you want to get a title. And people are very enamored with a title. So I ransacked my third edition of the Big Book. That's the one I grew up with. And I looked, anything that you would recognize or even things that you wouldn't recognize in the Big Book was either being used or being taken. So I was flipping through the stories, and I saw one of the stories in the back was Rum, Radio, and Rebellion. Oh, and I go, gee, Rum Radio, what a great name, because it's easy to remember. You know, rum for rummies. It just had a nice ambiance to it. Now, how many people would know that? Some do, only if the ones who've read all the stories, which are few and far between. But that is in the Big Book. Rum Radio is in the Big Book. It's not just about rum, it's just the name. It's a good name. So I started using that, and it's a slow go in the beginning because I'm really not astute in the technology area. So we've done the best I could, or we could, and to get the word out. I was in Austin. Have you ever been? You've been to Austin, how are you? Isn't that where you?
Yeah, Justin? I've been to quite a few CA groups out there. Quite a few guys. There's a guy named Ivan and Jaime out there, and they got a really good CA fellowship out there in Austin, Texas, actually.
They do. There's a fella out there, Harris, who put together several AA clubs, groups rather, Firestarters, Bridge to Shore. And he does the Citywide. You familiar with Citywide?
No, I think maybe Ivan might have been a part of that. He was the one that every time he was interesting. One thing I remember about Austin was a speech that this man, Ivan, gave at a CA meeting. And he said, you know, you can't start a spiritual journey based on a lie. And that always stuck to me.
Yeah, it goes along with what Mark Twain said, you can't pray a lie.
Yep, that's right.
And so I was in Austin, and I was at the Primary Purpose Club down there. And, of course, I'm promoting Rum Radio. And I mentioned it in my share, and some people came up to me after the meeting, and I give out these cards directing them to the website. And this one fellow was kind of interested in it, and he invited me to the Liars Club. It was a men's club, a men's group in down on South Lamar in Austin. And it starts at, you know, it was a noon meeting. And I said, well, I'm planning on going back to Houston tomorrow, and so it doesn't really work into my plans. He said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll buy you lunch. I said, well, that's very nice of you. He said, no, come on down. I think you'll really enjoy the club. And since one of my main reasons for being in Austin was trying to get out the Rum Radio website. So, okay. So I went down there, and he bought me lunch, and we're having lunch. And after we finished lunch, we're sitting at the table. And the way they pick their meetings at this club is a perchance open of the Big Book. Wherever it happens to open, that's where they take their topic of discussion. It's usually agreed to, though, but the first 164 pages, because that's where the recovery is really centered in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first 164 pages. It's all laid out. So I started telling the folks at the table we were reading about Rum Radio, and this guy taps me on the shoulder, and he says, look where the Big Book opened. And it opened to the story Rum Radio and Rebellion. And I says, wow. That kind of blew me away, you know. I says, like, it was like a mini miracle. So they have a 3-minute egg timer. And their idea is that if you speak for more than 3 minutes, it's all about you.
Mm-hmm.
So they did a round robin, and I was the second or third one to speak, and I explained that this was a kind of a phenomenon. It was a little mini miracle, you know, because Rum Radio and Rebellion. And as we went around, one fellow objected it was supposed to be the first 164 pages. And then he said, no, that's okay. We're going to go with it. And information how Rum Radio got its name. To me, it was a sort of one of those aha moments. What I'd like to do now is tell a little bit about us and about his story, and I'll tell a little bit about my story, so you get an idea of who we are and what we're trying to accomplish. So, Justin, if you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience,
yeah,
strength, and hope in a general way.
Yeah, I'm Justin R., and anonymity purposes, I guess. I live out here in Houston, Texas. I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois. I firmly believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My drug of choice was heroin, though. And I was in and out of the program for many, many years. And, you know, for a long time, I always thought it was because I just didn't want it bad enough. And I would hear that a lot from people. You know, well, he just didn't want to get sober. You know, he wasn't ready. You know, that's why he keeps relapsing. And, you know, for a long time, I started believing that. You know, I started believing that maybe I just didn't want to stay sober. Maybe, you know, maybe I just couldn't and I never would. And, God, talk about a hopeless way of viewing life, that feeling of despair that things are never, ever going to change, no matter how hard I try, no matter how bad I wanted to change. And, you know, and over the years, you know, and I've done it myself, but I was a part of a lot of groups that focused a lot on the problems. You know, we talked a lot about the divorces. We talked a lot about the probation department. We talked a lot about the wives and the husbands and the kids. And, you know, and I thought that's what this was all about. You know, and it took many years to be introduced to a few people that, you know, explained to me really what this was about. It really, you know, it has nothing to do with the alcohol. It has nothing to do with the drugs. It has to do about persistently trying to be a better person. And, you know, and all those relapses that I had in turn actually became my greatest asset. I've been able through trial and error to learn many different things about myself and about other people. And ironically enough, every time there was a setback, a lesson was learned and has been able to benefit me. You know, today I don't have the same setbacks, obviously, as I used to. But now I have, you know, we all have those emotional setbacks, those emotional hangovers, or those days where, you know, it just feels like there's something more needed. You know, that's really where I've been at in my recovery now, is trying to find, kind of shape my belief structure a little bit more. And, you know, and that's one reason why I wanted to be involved in this, is for a long time a message wasn't carried to me. You know, a message, a clear message of what this was about, I never got, you know. And I was resentful to that for many years. And now I really, really want to focus on carrying a message to people that is clear, so at least they're given the opportunity to see what this is about. You know, at least they're given an opportunity to see the truth. You know, this isn't about some kind of right or wrong or this evangelist approach, or, you know, beat them in the head with the big book and we know this and this is right and this is wrong. And that's not the goal. You know, there was once a time in my life where I did view things that way. You know, there was a time in my life where, unfortunately, I was one of those people, if someone relapsed, you know, oh, well, I can't talk to you until you come back, you know. You know, until you're ready, you know, and just the arrogance of me. And you know, and there's a lot of people like that still today, you know, that think it's about the quantity. And I learned it's not about the quantity of how long a person's been sober, it's the quality. even if they have 1 hour, one day. You know, what they're sharing, is it sincere? What they're sharing, is it really who they want to be? You know, and I try not to look at people anymore for who they are. I try and look at people for who they can become. And in turn, I hope that people look at me the same way. You know, and not base it on my clean time. You know, myself, I'm coming up on a year, July 25th. And, you know, I've had really good sponsorship. And the knowledge that I've acquired, I'm the first to tell people that knowledge alone will not keep you sober. I'm very, very knowledgeable as far as the steps go and the literature's concerned. And, you know, that's nice. I got those gold stars, you know. But the bottom line is that's not really what this is all about. I mean, it's fun in conversation, and it's fun in a situation like this, and it comes in handy when it comes to sponsorship. But really what I'm trying to carry is the message that as a result of working the steps, you know, we can have the spiritual awakening the book promises. And regardless of any setbacks we may have, is to keep moving on and to know, to have true faith, you know, that everything has already been taken care of. Not that it's going to be, not that it will, that it already has been. And that's a new concept and perception that I, you know, I'm just beginning to understand. And continually want to work better to be the person that, you know, I always wanted to be. I wanted to be a good husband. I wanted to be a good father, a good brother, a good son. You know, for many, many years have passed where it's been about, oh, my God, you know, I used. Or, oh, my God, you know, there was a relapse. You know, now it's been about, oh, my God, I didn't, you know, I broke a promise, you know, to a seven-year-old. Those are things that I don't want to do today. You know, those are things about living life. And that's really what this program's about. It doesn't, nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous does it say, if you do this, you're not going to drink. Nowhere does it say, you know, if you do this, you know, you're not going to use drugs anymore. You're not going to do this. It's a design for living. It gives us a guide to live by some spiritual principles. You know, and as a result of that, you know, we stay sober. And, more importantly, is not knowing that mistakes will never happen. It's actually knowing that mistakes do happen. And I'm not necessarily talking about relapse, just, you know, setbacks in life in general. You know, dishonesty can creep up, resentments can creep up. More importantly, it's learning from these mistakes and understanding that I'm not God and that my job today is to make mistakes, but hopefully to make new ones. But when those do happen, to learn from them. You know, and that's where I'm really at today. Understanding that I'm human and understanding my human condition and trying to live as humanly as possible, but also not to the point where it, you know, there's no purpose. There is a purpose, you know, and there is a greater meaning, and to strive for that, you know, my own personal journey and to help others find their own personal journey. So that's where I'm at today.
That's great. Thanks, Justin. That's you've come a long way in such a very short period of time, but like you said, the time is really kind of irrelevant when it comes to recovery. Quality is so much more important than quantity. Little bit of my story. My name is Joseph G., and I'm a grateful recovered in recovery. I'm a refugee from several 12-step programs. AA is probably my primary, but also I'll say I'm an Alkanon. I tell my sponsees, if you really want to be an effective AA sponsor, Al-Anon is probably a good way to go because you're going to be dealing with a lot of alcoholics. I consider Al-Anon sort of like graduate AA. I came into the rooms because my wife had become unmanageable. She insisted I was an alcoholic, and I insisted I was not. So we negotiated for therapy. So I went to the therapist, and sometime down the road, the therapist said, how about not drinking for a year? And I said, well, that's crazy. I could quit any time, just not today. So nothing really changed. The wife had turned into the rant again about I'm an alcoholic. And I said, look, I'm telling you, I'm not an alcoholic. And she said, okay, until there's an Assholes Anonymous, I need you to go to ANA. So, you know, it's cheaper to keep her. So I agreed to start going to the Aquarius group in Dallas. I came in late, left early, didn't really listen to what those folks had to say. I couldn't really relate to that. To me, an alcoholic was someone who lived under the overpass and the Denisons and the cardboard boxes. And I certainly was nothing like that. I didn't really listen, so I didn't hear anything. Well, the divorce came down, and it was brutal, like most divorces are. This seemed very brutal to me, but it was. It was a very brutal divorce, and that beat me into a state of reasonableness. Being reasonable means I'm teachable, a broken heart and a contrite spirit. So brokenhearted, the only place I needed to go, I was going to go out drinking on a tear. I was going to call a buddy of mine, and I said, I don't even like this guy. And I had this moment of clarity where I needed to get back to AA. Time was wasting, and I needed to do something. And I went there at 6 o'clock, and I cried, and people were glad that I was there. And see, now I'm teachable. So the first thing they told me to do was to get a sponsor. And I looked for this fellow, Jack. I says, is Jack still around? Jack was a dentist at one time who had lost his professional credentials because of drug and alcohol use. It's got to be a tough deal for a professional man like that. And he had a little window cleaning business. Well, I say little, but that was what he did. And he tried to get back into his profession as an assistant or in a smaller capacity, and they wouldn't even let him do that. And being so despondent, instead of putting another drink of alcohol in his body, he went to Bachman Lake and blew his brains out. That was my first experience with death in AA. Soon after, my ex-wife now insisted that Dallas was too small for the both of us, and it seemed like all doors were closed to me, and I headed off for Austin. I had a little business. I had a little van. I sold neon art sculptures. And headed out there and in an ice storm, saying, the Lord loves me and wants to see me happy. And the first thing I did when I landed was I got to the telephone and called up Intergroup to find out where the closest AA meeting would be. And it was the Hope Group in Cedar Park, Texas. And I didn't know my way around, so the guy gave me directions. And he said, you go down this road, and it was the last house on the block, and that you couldn't miss it. It was a place where alcoholics would go. So I found the place, and I walked in, and it was pretty ramshackle. Dirty yellow carpet, smoke. You know, I was still smoking at the time, thank goodness. And the funny thing about it is I felt right at home. I felt comfortable there. And I picked up a sponsor right away, Kenneth. Not a fellow I normally would have picked up. He was recently, he was a Mensa guy, but he had gone so far down that he was living in a pump house on Lake Austin. But very spiritual for an agnostic, he's a very spiritual man. And that spirituality was the thing that got me with Kenneth, and we started working the steps. Well, I'm a real chatterbox, so I'm talking in the meetings, and I'm feeling really good about it. And I'm deciding, well, you know, my sponsor's going, when are you going to work a fourth step? Well, I'm staying sober. Is that not enough? And he says, no, it's not enough. And it was enough for me for a very long period of time. Until life on life's terms put me into motivation. I tell my sponsees now, no talking in the meetings until you've worked the fifth step. The pain, right, you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I know where you're going with this. Go ahead.
What I've realized is that when I was talking to the meeting, something magical happens in a meeting of AA, that when you're talking to the group about your pain, the pain dissipates. It just goes away. You're being accepted by a new group. You know, there's the fellowship of the spirit, and the meetings become the end all. You know, they're fun. They're sexy. There's pretty girls in there and, you know, auditioning and a lot of laughs, and we have a good time in those meetings, but that's not the recovery. You're going to hear things that aren't AA, but it's okay because you're staying sober. I'm going to meetings. Is that not enough? And it was enough for me for years, but I didn't work the steps. I kept putting it off for years and years until life on life's terms. I had some tragedies in my life which put me in a position where I had to start working the steps again. And it was until I worked those steps that I finally got relief from life. Now, I wasn't drinking. I was dry drunk for a lot of years. Never really, the promises really didn't come true in my life, but I was okay. Anyway, so that's my story.
You know, that seems to be a common story with a lot of people, is, you know, that we hear about now today, is how, you know, for people coming to the program, you know, a 12-step program, and, you know, they come to the meetings and they hear a lot of the cliches that we hear nowadays about 90 meetings in 90 days and meeting makers make and all these things. And, you know, there's some validity to those things. They're all good suggestions. But I think what you said, you know, is one of the most important things is when we first get there, the pain is so great that it, that circumstances, you know, they do make us willing to take the step. And without that, you know, we stick around for a few months. I can't, you know, and I've been that person myself, but there's so many people that are, you know, you talk to them and they don't understand that they're miserable, absolutely miserable. Been sober 3-4 months, 5 months, 6 months, and just completely miserable. And you ask them, well, where are you at in your step work? Well, I'm, you know, I'm in the middle of my 4-step. And, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, because you got to ask these people, it's like, okay, well, what are you waiting for? Because there's nothing, you know, a guy told me, there's nothing that I'm going to write down. First of all, it's not going to jump off the paper and bite me. You know, it's just black and white. It's just pen. But everything that I'm writing down already has happened. You know, all we're doing is taking an honest look at, like, what's happened, what's working, and what's not working. And there's such freedom in that. And it's just, I don't know where it's been distorted over the years or why it's become such an issue where it's been fear revolves so much around this 4-step. But, you know, when I say there's really nothing to it, there's really nothing to it. I mean, you disagree or you agree on that?
Oh, yeah, I had a hard time with the 4-step laid out, and that was after I was in the program for years. It's just I'm not the brightest staff peach in the basket, but I'm not the dumbest either. And it just seemed like quite a, you know, who's Mrs. Brown? You know, the whole concept is laid out seemed very daunting. And a newcomer coming in looking at this stuff is really quite threatened by it. They hear all these stories about how hard it is and, you know, and you know, like, oh, no, no way. I'm going to – and they start it and they put it down and they put it away. And it takes discipline. And the problem with discipline is it takes motivation. The problem with motivation is not now becomes never.
Right.
So once I didn't have the not now, I never got around to it. But I had a good rap, you know. I had the AA rap. I knew all the lingo. I knew all the catchphrases, and you know, and I could tell a funny story and all that. But I didn't actually do the work.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until I got to that.
Yeah, and you know, I've been there myself, you know, and. I remember the first time it was hard, and, you know, and then I ran across a guy that said, you know, don't worry about looking at, you know, like you said, the diagram with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Brown and all that. And he said, look, I just want you to write down one column. He said, you know, I just want you to write down everybody that you may be angry with. Or he explained to me, you know, resentment was also a reoccurring thought or feeling. He said, you might not be pissed off about this anymore, but does it ever cross your mind on a day-to-day basis? And that was, you know, he put it down in terms that were simple for me, you know, and had me just do the first column, you know. And then he said, okay, well, you know, why are you angry with these people, or why is this coming up, you know. And I think absolutely what you say is a lot of times people have heard for so long that, oh, God, this is so hard, or this is that, and this is that, that they already get these, kind of like, you know, Herbert Spencer in the back of the book when it says contempt prior to investigation. You know,
one of my sponsors
I had in San Antonio, Texas, his name is Big Book Dick, and he always, when he first sponsored people, he would have them read that quote, he'd start in the back of the book, you know, to remind people, hey, let's not spit on these ideas before we investigate them. You know, I think that's important.
It's, you know, the reason why that's in the big book, the reason why the concept of open-mindedness, principles before personalities, because I believe as a group, we have a tendency to latch on to something, and then that's the way and the only way, and then we're locked into that.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that deviates from that is a threat.
Mm-hmm.
I heard this
from
the...
Go ahead.
I heard this in a Survivors Club here in Houston, a fellow by the name of J.D. He has 21 years sober, and he sobered up at the Pacific Group in California, Clancy Eyes home group. A lot of good recovery come out of that. And he said the way his sponsor took him through the fourth step, I have it on the website, it's an abbreviated fourth and fifth step. And he said he had a notepad. He couldn't find it, but it was like 30 years old, 20 years ago. And the way they had set it up, so this thing was around, like it's been around 50-something years. And it was brief, brief, brief. And all you put on was no more than you could put on one side of a yellow legal pad, the name, the date, and the incident. And that was it. And then when you sat down with your sponsor, you went over everything else as outlined in the fourth step. What was your part? How did it affect you? The positive inventory, the negative inventory, the sex inventory, all of it. The seven deadly sins. All you did all that from that information when you sat down and did your fifth step.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried that on several sponsees, and it works really well. I called my sponsor up of 34 years, and I said, Bob, I says, what do you think of this? Is this deviating so far out of the big book that this would cause contention or dissension? And he said, let me tell you, he says, the only requirement in the big book to do a fourth step is that it has to be written. He mm-hmm. says, I had a sponsee who wrote a one-sentence fourth step, and he's been sober for 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I've used that.
You got that. There's always that question that comes about is, you know, am I writing enough? You know, people think we're to made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. They think, you know, I've been one of those that, oh, my God, I have to get every single thing down. If I miss something, you know, I'm going to go out, I'm going to get drunk. And, you know, we forget that, you know, step 10 is really, you know, steps 4 through 9 compacted. And Bill Wilson, when the steps were written, you know, it worked out just the way it was supposed to. It's almost like he knew, okay, this is what's going to happen. You know, things are going to come about. You know, we forget things. People have blackouts. People, you know, there's been many times where years later people come up to me and say, hey, you remember when this happened? And I got to look them right in the eye and say, no, I really don't remember that happened. You know, and there's, you know, we have those moments, you know, where things that I thought did happen, you know, didn't happen, you know. And when you get into that four step, the three inventories, you know, you talked about it. We have the resentments, we have the fear, and we have the sex inventory. And for a lot of years, you know, I missed the point that what we're trying to do is we're trying to get rid of the bulk of it. You know, we're trying to get away. We're trying to get rid of the things that are blocking us right now. You know, as a buddy of mine says, what's eating your lunch right now? I mean, the stuff that happened to me when I was in first grade or kindergarten, hey, yeah, we can talk about that, and that can be written down. But is that something you're still really thinking about today? If it is, yeah, you know what? Maybe there's some more validity to that than, you know, than we thought. But if it's not, we're not going to sit there for half an hour and discuss it. You know, we're trying to find out some things here. You know, we're trying to see what the book talks about, and it gives us the answers. You know, it tells us that driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, you know, we step on the toes of our fellows and, you know, they retaliate seemingly without provocation, you know, but we find that, you know, something we've done based on self that put us in a position to be hurt later on. And it gets us away from that victim role. It gets us away from, you know, oh my God, everybody's against me. You know, and that's one thing that I learned in my four step, that I wasn't a victim. I was a volunteer. You know, and it gets down to even the nitty gritty thing. You know, I myself, you know, had some physical abuse when I was a child. You know, back then it probably wasn't so much considered physical abuse as today it would be. But, you know, and I remember working with my sponsor and saying, you know, well, how is this my fault? You know, when I was doing my four step, I said, well, you know, I was a kid. You know, yeah, I made mistakes, but, you know, I didn't deserve this. You know, I was a victim in those situations. And he said, yes, Justin, but the difference is that you're still staying the victim. He says, what you're doing, your part of it today is that you're still holding on to it. You know, instead of being a survivor, you know, you're still living in the past with it. And that's no longer about that person anymore. It's about you. You know, that was a hard pill to swallow, you know, and I remember a friend of mine, you know, she was raped, and God, you know, she was definitely a victim. You know, she didn't deserve that. And when she heard me talk about, you know, the abuse that I went through, she kind of, you know, she used the same principles towards her situation, and as harsh as it may seem to some people listening, you know, she faced the same reality that, you know what, she was a victim at the time. This happened, you know, over a decade ago. And now responsibility lied on her holding on to it. And that's, you know, that's one of the key points she learned in her four step. You know, it's something I learned in mine, is that a lot of times it's not so much about, you know, finding out new information. It's just becoming aware of it. You know, and that's the process of the whole spiritual awakening, you know, is the spirit awakened and being aware of the truth, of what things really are, the way things really are, you know, not the way that I thought things were. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. Two points. One is that most people end up doing more than one fourth step anyway, because things will come up as you progress spiritually and emotionally. So Bill W. did two fifth steps, so the assumption is he did two fourth steps. So to get to the sunlight of the spirit is really our goal in doing the fourth step, to get to the fifth step.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of true kinship between God and man. The other point is, I had a sponsee one time, and I had just heard what you just said just before I worked with the sponsee. This is several years ago. Nice kid. He's Mr. AA now. And his resentment was, as a child, he was sexually molested by his stepfather, who was a evangelical blah, blah. And he had a hard time with the concept of Jesus because of that. Now, I don't push Jesus. That's my higher power, but I don't push it on anybody. I tell people if they don't have a higher power, we can just use to whom it may concern. But he was having that hard time. And so we got to that point in the fourth step, in the fifth step, where he said he was molested. And what was his part? And I told him his part, and that I had just learned this, was that he was holding on to it. That he, as long as he held on to it, that was he could never progress from there. He had to let it go, and that made all the difference in his recovery.
Well,
did I lose you there for a second?
Yeah, we got, there's a little technical. Sometimes it gets, you know, when we're using the Blog Talk Radio, you know, it's all done through the air, through cell phones, and as well as technology has progressed over the years, I guess they still haven't figured out how to make a solid connection without getting a call dropped.
Amen.
Kind of funny. It's just like, you know, all the 12-step programs. It's funny because, you know, all the stuff we're talking about is nothing new. You kind of touched on that, you know, even talking about an inventory, you know, it's, you can go back to biblical times. You can go to self-help books, everything from Dr. Phil to, you know, Oprah and all psychiatrists and therapists, priests, you know, all these different aspects, different professions people believe in, you know, that there's definitely a real power between, you know, getting honest with oneself and sharing it with an individual, you know, and let's get into steps 4 and 5, but, you know, knowing the truth alone doesn't have the same benefit as sharing it with another human being.
No.
Well,
it's in the 12 and 12. I'm sorry, say that again?
What are you saying, the 12 and 12?
Well, the 12 and 12 says, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone, and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. That step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of true kinship between God and man. So what it's asking us to do is not only do a fifth step, but hear a fifth step. And until we do that, we still didn't belong. So we're just circling the field, waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, preparing for the crash and burn one more time.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, it's in the 12 and 12. It's in the step 5.
I've read it a few times.
So we're supposed to, I've said that a couple times at the meeting, and finally this one fella jumped up and he says, oh, because a lot of folks don't want to sponsor. Well, I'm not going to be a good sponsor, so I'm not going to do it. You know, sponsorship is not for me. No, it's for everybody. It's like the real world. 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work.
Yeah, you know what? I believe that. I really do.
If
if you look at, you know, and not to sound like a martyr, but, you know, just the success rates alone. You know, right now in Houston, Texas, you know, the people picking up, you know, a year chip, you know, it's hovering right around about 6% right now. 6%. You know, and if you look at certain, you know, parts back in the Midwest, you know, in the late 30s, early 40s, you know, you were looking at success rates in some parts of the book talked about 90, 95%.
Yeah,
you
at
know,
least
nowadays,
75 to 90%, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, at least 75%, you know, and it was pretty much guaranteed that, you know, it talked about in some of the forwards about, you know, half the people coming in were staying sober, then, you know, then another 25% of extra people that would come in, you know, after a couple times, you know, a little slips here and there would finally get it. So even at the worst results, they were looking at 75% after, you know, some time. And it's like now, you know, and it's like, you know, this has been addressed since they had the conference in 75 about how things have changed. And you would think that more people would be more outspoken about this issue considering the effects it's having on people, you know, and the people that, you know, are dying, the people that aren't sticking around, that, you know, are relapsing, and families afflicted by this, and you think why this wouldn't be an issue, especially with people that have worked the steps, that are trying to get involved in service, you know, and this is just strictly my opinion, but I think this should be the main issue of every group that's, you know, trying to do more service, is, okay, well, how can we carry this message clearer to people? You know, that's what our primary purpose is. So why don't we do that, so to speak?
No, my experience, and this is another reason for Rum Radio, was that, you know, I get by doing the work, I get more and more information all the time. And one of the information pieces I got was kind of disconcerting. According to the GSO, in 1981, there was 2 million people registered or understood to be belonging to the groups of AA. Now, of course, it's like counting cats, and the numbers are probably askew at best, but the same GSO, so considering the same reporting agency, there would be the same error rate. 2010, January of 2010, was 2,100,000.
Wow.
The population has increased by a full third since then.
Mm-hmm.
So if we flatlined, there should be 3 million.
Mm-hmm.
So we've lost a lot of ground.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people that don't understand, you know, really where some of this came about. You know, when Richard Nixon was in office, you know, on his way out, you know, obviously Nixon had his faults, but you know what? Richard Nixon did understand that alcoholism and drug addiction was a disease. He did. And I got a buddy of mine that talks about this thing here I'm sharing. But, you know, on his way out, he signed this legislator. Basically, what it did, it got rid of this thing called certification of need. And what it did is it enabled us to basically open a treatment center in every corner. You know, they're like Starbucks. You know, and back in the day, treatment, you know, we're talking about the 70s and 80s. You know, we're looking at about $30,000-$40,000 a month. You know, and of course, we have places like that today. But back then, you know, that was the normal going rate. And any insurance policy, you know, you could get back then, at the bottom, they had the little clause that said, oh, okay, you need treatment? Well, yeah, we'll cover that too. Because back then, you know, the insurance companies, they saw dollar signs, okay? And for a long time, you know, this was a very big money-making machine, was the alcohol and drug treatment field. Well, what happened is people got greedy, and, you know, there's a lot of people that ended up going to jail for this kind of stuff, you know, scamming, and, you know, they were pulling drug addicts off the street, you know, heroin addicts off the street, saying, hey, come on, you know, you hungry? You know, it's warm in here, there's some women in here, you know, and they didn't even want to get clean, you know, but they put them in there anyway, and, you know, there's a lot of people that went to jail over that stuff, and the problem is in the late 90s is, that, well, guess what, the pendulum has swung the other way. And these insurance companies now, they're like, well, hold on a second. We're not paying this anymore. It's not paying out like it used to, and it's making it real difficult on people to seek help today. But unfortunately, not only did that whole incident have that effect, what also happened is in the 70s and 80s, you had a lot of people that ended up coming into the rooms of AA and other 12-step programs that really didn't need to be there. You know, they went to the treatment centers, the insurance took care of it, they said, okay, well, now you need to go here. You know, and they end up coming into the meetings and sharing as if they were in a process group in their treatment center. And guess what? Now you got those people that got 20, 25 years sober, and unfortunately, those are the ones that people are listening to because we're concentrated so much on the time, you know, unlike the quality that we mentioned earlier. And as a result of that, they're the ones, you know, share the message of take your time, you know, you can wait a year before you work this desk, because those particular people could and can, you know, and, but we forget about what the big book talks about on page 21 when it talks about the real alcoholic. You know, the real alcoholic, the real drug addict is not going to be able to do that, you know, and I see now a shift lately in the last 5 years that more people are coming about, you know, kind of like, well, we're trying to get across in a way, and there's some primary purpose groups around the country and around the world that are trying to carry that message to it, saying, hey, you know what? You know, everybody's welcome. Third tradition says the only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. You know, we understand that, and we welcome people, but let's be careful when we're sharing these meetings, because there's people that come in here that aren't going to, they're not going to jive with you. They don't have the same experience. They're not going to get what you're saying. They want to know, does anybody, can you wake up in the morning and not want to drink, not want to use? You know, how do you do that? You know, that window of opportunity when the guy comes in, you know, he's around for 2 months, and then the guy goes back out and he dies, and then you got, you know, these, for lack of better words, I apologize, but these jerks that show up to the funeral and say, oh, man, no, you just didn't want it. You just, I mean, that makes me sick. It makes me sick because, who wouldn't? You know, who really want? I mean, Joseph, think about it. Did you ever for 1 second say, you know what, I think that today's a good day to mess up my family. Today's a good day to lose my job. You know, today's a good day to just screw up my health and scare the women and the children and just mess everything up. You know, I don't think that was anybody's goal, and I don't think any drug addict or alcoholic, even in their active addiction, you know, says this is what I want to do. And unfortunately, people don't understand that, you know, that willpower has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with how bad a person wants to or doesn't want to. You know, and if we can get that message clear to people, you know, Dr. Bob mentioned it. When he got that message from Bill and he understood the medical aspect of this disease, he was able to muster to willingness to do this that he never could before, because he understood, once again, for lack of better words, that he was screwed. You know, and if we can let people know, love them, but love them enough to tell them the truth, I think people like, you know, we mentioned about ourselves would be more apt to follow these suggestions.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah, you got it. The one point I'd address with it is that the year. When I got to Houston, the club I went to, their deal was to take you through a step a month.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that would take you a year to get through, and that at the end of the year, having worked your steps, now you're in a position to become a sponsor. And that didn't really sit well, but, you know, this is the way they did business here. And then I had a sponsee from New Jersey. He was ship's captain, like Joe Hazelton kind of deal, an oil tanker captain. Really nice fella, chronic relapser, been in and out of the program since 94. And I think the longest he had was 5 years. And he picked up a beginner's chip. It's a win, and I grabbed them right after. I like to get them when they first get their beginner's chip. And I think they're hot. That's when they're ready to go. They're in enough pain to go get that chip. They're ready to do something. And before they start to languish in the rooms. So we had a nice talk. But he knew relapses are always tougher to work with than a newcomer, to me. They know just enough to be dangerous. So I said, well, how do they, you know, so we got to know each other. And in New Jersey, the way they worked it at his club, I'm sure it's not all over Jersey, I'm positive of that, but in his particular group was that you had to go to meetings for a year before we meet the steps.
Let me get this straight. You said you had to go to meetings for a year before you work the steps?
Yes.
That's amazing because, you know, back in the day, you couldn't even walk into a meeting until you started working the steps.
Basically, you had to work the first three steps before you could go to a meeting.
Yeah, you couldn't even go to a meeting until you'd done the first three steps. And now they're saying, well, you need to go to meetings for a year before you can even work the steps. I mean, it's funny. Nobody ever questions these. Well, I mean, there's people that do, but you think there'd be more people that would say, hold on. This doesn't make any sense. What are we doing, you know?
No, they didn't. No, actually. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
They didn't question it. Matter of fact, when he brought this information back with him, he came under attack. Not only did the people not work the steps with a sponsor, he said most of the time the sponsor would send them to step studies.
Mm. So once again, we're going back to the original topic that we started a couple days ago, is where really the problem, you know, boils down to, you know, crappy sponsorship. People not, you know, it's more about an ego trip and about, you know, and I hate to sound pessimistic, but, you know, let's call a spade, you know, a lot of times today it's more about, you know, the ego. It's about, well, I, you know, I'm sponsoring 15 guys. Well, you know, telling somebody to go to a step study or to fill out a worksheet, you know, in my opinion, is a sponsorship. You know,
no, of course not.
You're trying to be a therapist. That's what you're trying to do there. Even a therapist talks with their, you know, their clients. But, yeah, you know what, there should be more responsibility, and, you know, and I take it seriously, and I know my sponsor does. It's, you know, this isn't about, you know, a race to see who can, you know, who's more important or who thinks they're more important, and unfortunately it's like that nowadays, and, you know, if you get into the literature and the history, it wasn't like that back then. You know, I know they referred to their sponsees as pigeons and babies in different parts of the country, but you know what? You know, the terms were in terms of endearment, you know, to their sponsees, and they viewed it as a privilege, they viewed it as an honor, and, man, you know, I hope that comes about more often, you know, in the future.
Well, that's what we're here for. It's going to have to be, at this point in time, it's almost a cultural shift. The culture is very ingrained in a particular modality or a certain way of doing business. And anything that threatens the status quo is considered outside the realm of understanding. Anytime a new idea comes before its time, if it's an idea before its time, first it'll be met with ridicule and then with violent opposition and then acceptance when the violent opposition passes away. That's just the natural scheme of things. But I think there's a movement out now in the rooms to get back to more of a basics approach to sponsorship. The word's starting to get out. Other people, I usually suggest 30 to 45 days from the time he gets his beginner's chip to get him through all 12 steps. And that after step 5, he's now in a position, not only can he talk in the meeting, the reason why I have him say, now, okay, now you can talk in the meeting because now you're available to be a temporary sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellows who do that stay sober. Now, some do. Some stay sober without doing it, you know, and their deal is just like everybody else, I'm staying sober. Is that not enough? Most folks don't want to take the responsibility of accountability. They either don't know what they're doing or they're too busy to put anything else on the plate, especially the well-being of another human being.
Yeah.
So it's selfishness.
That's what it's all, yeah, and unfortunately that's what it's all about, though. You know, is that altruistic claim, you know, and it's exactly what it mentions, you know, over and over and over and over again all throughout the book.
Yeah, and I think we've lost some of the message, and yeah, trying to bring it back. Let's bring it back.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back to where it used to work the best. This isn't anything new. Matter of fact, this is what's old.
Well, you know, they always say, if it's not broke, don't try and fix
don't
it.
Don't fix it. So that's right.
I think, you know, over the years, and you know, I've been guilty myself, trying to do things different and trying to do things that way and tweak it up a little bit here and there. And you know what? And that is one thing I think different, though, that we're bringing to the table is, you know, we understand that there are some things that can be tweaked a little bit, you know, and there are some other ways of carrying a message and also giving out new information. But what we're trying to make clear is, first and foremost, the basics should come first. The foundation needs to come first. You know, once that has been accomplished, and then by all means, encourage the fact of finding other avenues to grow spiritually.
The Big Book is a spiritual work. There's no doubt about it. It was designed by God for a particular group of people to help us get well. There's no reason to use anything other than the Big Book, and I believe the 12 and 12 is a concordance of understanding through experience of application. But we should remain open to ideas and suggestions that we find to be productive and to best service our fellow beings. And I'll end with this, and we're just about out of time. When we're in the service of our fellow beings, are we not in the service of our God? And when we're in that service, and we're in that moment, and we're in that time, are we not not only are we in the moment, and when in that moment, is that not when we make our conscious contact with our Creator, who lives from moment to moment, eternity to eternity, life everlasting? The magic words in AA is action and more action. For faith without works is dead.
Absolutely. All right, well, that's pretty much
well, we have about 60 seconds.
Tonight.
Do you have any last thoughts?
No, it's just that, you know, we encourage people to listen in, and, you know, we're going to encourage people to call, and, you know, please be patient with us. We are new at this, and it's a work in progress. And, you know, we encourage people out there to get involved and to share their experience about, you know, where they're from and their thoughts may be, and come together and make something happen. Starts with, you know, just a couple people. That's how this whole thing started in the beginning. Just a couple of people.
Yeah, two guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All
well,
right.
You have a good evening.
Do we know when the next show will be yet, or it'll be posted?
Well, no, we hadn't discussed it. I was thinking maybe Wednesday.
Okay, same time?
Yeah, Wednesday, same time.
All right, we'll have the post up for that. So we'll
okay,
see
great.
Y'all then Wednesday.
See you then.